Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
You're listening to the Simply Vegan podcast, the show that's all about making veganism easy, fun, and accessible. Brought to you by the team at Vegan Food and Living, the UK's best-selling vegan magazine. You can catch us every Tuesday and every Thursday. In today's eye-opening episode, I speak to the director of new film, The End of Medicine, along with the whistleblower at the centre of the film. We discuss some of the shocking issues raised, including antibiotic resistance, the state of factory farming, and the potential for future pandemics, along with the very human cost of our current food systems. Life can be hectic, and finding fresh and nutritional vegan recipes can become another thing to worry about. But don't worry, our best-selling magazine, Vegan Food and Living, is on hand to help. You can join us today and by visiting veganfoodandliving.com/podcast or using code podcast when you order with us. Choose between our print and digital plus membership to receive the latest issue to your door or to your device, along with having easy access to thousands of plant-based recipes at your fingertips in our fully searchable digital magazine archive. Join us today and make cooking delicious vegan food that much more exciting by visiting veganfoodandliving.com/podcast. Today, I am joined by BAFTA award-winning director Alex Lockwood and pig vet turned activist Dr. Alice Brough. Hi, guys. How are you?
Hello. Well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. It's Alice, we chatted to you back in series four, didn't we? It was one of my favourite episodes. I'm not just saying that. It was it was so kind of eye-opening and inspirational. And a lot of the things we chatted about on the podcast are actually part of the new film that you and Alex have worked on, aren't they? The End of Medicine.
Yeah, absolutely. There's definitely some overlap because I think when I came on, it was more regarding the legal case against the UK government. So yeah, very similar themes.
Yeah. So it's executively produced by Joaquin Phoenix and Rooney Mara. How did that come about?
Yeah, so basically when we started making this film before COVID-19 was reported on. And after it came about, Rooney and Joaquin, they decided they wanted to make a film on this subject. And then I don't know how far into that process they got, but at some point they realized that we were doing the same thing. And they'd worked with Keegan before, and it just seemed a natural fit to just kind of join forces, you know. And they've been brilliant to work with, you know. It's a bit of a bit of a dream for me, really.
I can imagine. I know. I was like, can we have Whacking on the podcast as well?
Yeah. No, it was kind of like when we started making the project, we thought maybe when the film's finished, we'll try and line up with, an executive producer, because that's a lot of films. You end up with an exec at the end who helps with the sort of publicity. Whereas to get exactly the people we wanted to have involved right from the start and having their feedback on drafts and just their ideas has been really, really amazing, to be honest.
It's incredible. So Alex, your background is in film, but what led you to take more of an interest in the environmental side of things?
So basically I was originally making corporate films, which I absolutely detested, because it was just when, it's just so kind of, I was making films that weren't necessarily in line with my values.
Yeah.
And then I was kind of looking for a film that I could make in my spare time to kind of show what I could do, but get out of making corporate films. And my wife, Nishat, found an article on this farmer who was basically going to give up beef farming and give all of his cows to a sanctuary. And we made that film. And that process showed me that, like, I don't really want to do anything else. I just want to keep making films and promote this message, and particularly learning from that farmer and learning from that experience and seeing what reaction we got to that and the impact even a short film can have. I thought, wow, if we can keep doing this and make feature films and seeing the impact of other documentaries as well, I just thought, this is what I want to be, making films that actually are going to have a bit of an impact,
Definitely. So that was 73 Cows, wasn't it, that film? And that was what won you a BAFTA, is that right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So were you vegan then when your wife kind of said about this farmer that was, going to give up beef farming for organic, basically plant-based farming?
No, I was vegetarian and I was heading towards being vegan. And I think I would have ended up there regardless, but this absolutely sort of fast-tracked that process, particularly hearing from Jay himself, somebody who's actually involved in producing beef, and hearing that the reason that he switched to making beef was that he felt it was kinder than producing milk. And that was a real eye-opener for me, because I think a lot of people imagine the meat industry is worse than the dairy industry or the egg industry. And learning that actually that's not the case at all, that was something that really fast-tracked my decision to go vegan. I think I couldn't have come out on the other side of making that film and not ended up being vegan, to be honest.
Yeah. Let's talk about The End of Medicine. So it's quite heavy going, isn't it? I've watched it sort of in two parts. I mean, it's an incredible film and I hope everybody watches it, especially people who aren't vegan. I mean, if I wasn't vegan, I'd definitely be, giving up meat right now after watching it. A few of the stats that shocked me were there are 8 billion humans on the planet and 80 billion animals being raised for food. In the US, 60 to 70% of pork and beef contains E. coli and 92% of chicken products. 70% of the world's antibiotics are fed to animals. So there's some sort of really shocking parts of the film, isn't there? And Alice, it's so nice to see you as like the star of the film. I mean, you are amazing. After I spoke to you in, back in series four, you were such an inspiration, and I'm, it's amazing seeing you.
Oh, thank you.
In such a sort of a big part of a film like this. So shall we talk about some of the issues that the film raises? So part one focuses on pandemics, doesn't it? And it's funny to hear you say that it, the film, you kind of started to work on the film before COVID broke out.
Yeah, which is, it was really weird, because obviously we're making a film in part about pandemics and then one actually happens. So The film had to kind of change direction a little bit, from being something that was just a warning about something that could potentially happen in the future to being something that was also reacting to what's happening here and now, but not to the extent that it becomes a COVID film, because it's not. We touch on COVID, of course, we'd have to really, but it's not a film about COVID, if that makes sense.
No, it's not. The film touches on the fact that we kind of think this is a problem sort of somewhere else in the world. You know, wet markets, we don't have that here. So, you know, we're okay. And it's, I mean, there was a lot of, there's a scene that talked about, you know, racism towards, you know, Asian Chinese people, because we were kind of blaming them. But it's happening, you know, right here, isn't it, Alice?
Yeah, I think one of the main things, I mean, the film started production probably off the back of the fact that scientists for years have been sort of forecasting a global pandemic, you know, and the most common, most likely scenario would be something like an avian influenza or a swine flu, like we saw in 2009, because, you know, pigs and chickens are the most intensively farmed, and they're in such high numbers that generally that's the most likely scenario. The fact that it came from a wet market, you know, it's the very same issue, just in a different place with maybe different species involved. You know, the way that animals are kept in wet markets, cramped, unhygienic, stressed, is exactly reflective of, you know, the UK pig industry or the poultry industry. It's no different, and it, you know, it's just luck of the draw where it starts off, I guess.
It's just, I guess, more behind closed doors, isn't it, with factory farming? Because, you know, like in China, you can just wander around a wet market, I guess, and see it all there being, you know, done in front of your eyes, whereas here it's all hidden, which is not any better.
Yeah, it's very sanitized, isn't it? And we're sold a very good image, and particularly in Britain, I think, of livestock farming being this like old country tradition and, you know, all lovely fields and things, but it's very much a horror show on the inside.
Yeah, I mean, tell us about some of your experiences. I know, obviously, last time you were on the show, you explained what it was like being a pig vet and why you gave that up. But for anyone who hasn't listened to that episode, just give us a brief overview of what, you know, your journey was like.
Yeah, it was an interesting one, because I kind of went into the industry as a very heavy meat eater, very like pro farming, from a sort of livestock farming family background. And I didn't quite realize until I started going around, you know, many, you know, hundreds of farms, and seeing the same hideous suffering, the same disease issues, the same amount of antibiotics having to be prescribed at every visit, you know, that I realized how widespread these issues were.
And even on family farms, wasn't it? That's because I know a lot of meat eaters that I know will say, oh, but I don't eat that kind of meat. And I'm like, yeah, bite your tongue, Holly. Don't say anything. Don't cause a scene.
Yeah. It's hard. It's really hard not to cause a scene all the time. But I mean, my experience with family farms were very varied, and I think that is reflective of farming in general. It is very varied. Most meat does come from intensive agriculture now. That's just the way of the world, and that includes Britain. But the sort of smaller family farms are not exempt from the suffering. They're not exempt from disease. And in certain circumstances, it was almost worse on those farms, because it wasn't as well regulated or monitored, and it wasn't turning a profit in the same way. So I think, and ultimately they all end up at the same slaughterhouse, which is hideous on all fronts. So I think that argument is not a valid one at all. And I think also this is mentioned in the film, but if we want meat from many small sort of free range or higher welfare and inverted commas farms, we simply do not have the land and resources to do that. So it's just not a viable option, really.
Yeah, I mean, something that sort of struck me, you were saying about the smaller farms, is they don't have as much money, so they can't necessarily treat the animals when they need to be treated, or, you know, with antibiotics and things like that. So actually, it's not always the better option at all.
No, I mean, I picked up a farm sort of later on in my 4 years in the industry that had been not had an inspection for 20 years. It was just like a sort of family farm. They had like a farm shop attached and they were selling like their own meat. And they'd had like a small animal vet prescribing them, as in like a cat and dog vet prescribing them vaccines and medications as they needed it without any experience in dealing with livestock or pigs. And I went in and you could hear the coughing like a mile off, and I did some post-mortems. Like, they looked awful, these pigs. They were like, some of them skeletal, yellow, like just absolutely hideous. And I did some post-mortems. I remember opening up the chest cavity and the lungs were like black and like abscessated. And that has just stuck with me, because that was like a, you know, they've got a lovely family farm shop, and yeah, people are probably going in there thinking they're getting the best, and they're probably being charged for the best.
Yeah.
And what the reality is the pigs are suffering horrendously, and they're just riddled with disease that we don't know anything about because they didn't have any vets going there for 20 years. Yeah, pretty astonishing. But
that's unbelievable that is still happening in today. Oh, the poor pigs. I just can't bear it. I know last time we spoke and I was worried about watching the film, I must admit, because I am a massive wimp and I just get so emotional. And I was like, I've got to watch it. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't too bad. There was nothing, because I do worry about watching sort of vegan films in inverted commas, mm-hmm. because, and I know a lot of people I know who are vegan do, because you don't want to see real suffering. And it wasn't, you know, it didn't sort of cross the line. So well done on that.
Yeah, that's good to know, because we were really keen for it to be something that would be accessible and wouldn't have that, you know, overly scary feel, because, you know, it can really put people off watching something if they think they're going to see something graphic. And so we had to decide where the line was. And, you know, I got in touch with a lot of charities who and undercover filmmakers who sent me just tons of footage, and the bulk of it was just really, really difficult to watch. And it was kind of like, what should I include in the film, to the extent that we're showing what's going on enough that people get an idea, but not to the extent that it's graphic and gruesome and that you know, people aren't going to watch the film because of it.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine it would be like a horror film, wouldn't it? Doesn't sound like a nice job for you, Alex, having to sift through all that.
No, and this the thing about most of this footage, and most of it was filmed undercover, not on specific farms that have been targeted because they've had bad press, but just on random farms, just picked at random, and you see, whatever factory farm, it is really similar conditions. And we were invited into a few farms as part of making this film by people who genuinely felt they had nothing to hide. And I think a lot of that is because they've been sort of desensitized to it. But yeah, when you walk in as an outsider, and it's like, there's no way you could walk around those places and see those sites and smell what you can smell and think, yeah, this is absolutely hygienic and fine, and this isn't horrible for the animals, and this isn't going to cause issues in terms of disease. Yeah.
I think you did really well, Alex, to like just touch on the bits that needed, you know, you do need to have an image of what they're like so that you can understand why it's a problem. But I think it's done really well not to make it, you know, like traumatic viewing for anyone. And I think also that the people interviewed and the topics discussed are not always, certainly a lot of non-vegans interviewed from, you know, all across the scientific disciplines and farmers and medics and everything. So I think it hopefully will be a really good one for non-vegans to watch, because it doesn't feel like a vegan film, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
it's just pointing out the major issues, and you can very easily come to your own conclusions from that.
Exactly. I mean, another sort of whole section of the film focused on the human element of things. So even if you don't care about animals, you don't, you know, you're not thinking about animal cruelty or animal welfare or anything like that, it was still an eye-opener because, I mean, for example, you know, the filming in the US with the factory farms over there, and you had, you know, people dying of cancer, like in areas around the factory farms because of the, I mean, was it air pollution and water pollution and things like that?
Yeah. And I think lots of people don't realize how intrinsically linked animal agriculture is with social injustice. And a lot of people say things like, why are you focusing on animal injustice and not social injustice and other forms of human injustice? And the answer is that they're all one and the same and they're all linked. And hopefully this film shows that, you know, where these factory farms are placed, usually in poorer communities of people who aren't viewed as having the power to combat these places. You always see health issues come along with that. And so hopefully we shine a bit of light on that, because that was something that I think I had no idea about until we started researching for the film. And then we were like, wow, we need to touch on this because, you know, this is about people just as much as it's about animals.
Yeah, I think the whole film does sort of show how sort of how linked we all are. We're all on this same planet. And the more we interfere with nature, the more, you know, problems we're going to see for ourselves. So antibiotic resistance was another thing that the film explores. And this is something I've worried about for for years now. You had lots of kind of scientists. You even had the mayor of New York, didn't you? Was it the mayor of New York?
Yeah.
So, so many sort of experts and, you know, people who are in the know on there. So how does antibiotics resistance come into all this?
So antibiotics globally, most of them are used in livestock now. I think it's about 70% or over are used in livestock, and that is to prop up a system which is deeply inappropriate for the animals involved. You know, they literally cannot survive long enough to be slaughtered at 6 months, you know, 6 weeks, whatever animal it is, without the use of antibiotics. And that poses massive issues for us. I think when we started filming, the data showed that I think it was about 700,000 deaths a year due to antimicrobial resistance. That has now shot up catastrophically. To data this year suggests it's now nearly 5 million deaths associated with antimicrobial resistance every year. So the previous estimate from the World Health Organization of 10 million deaths a year by 2050 is way off. You know, this is something which is killing already many, many more people than a pandemic, and will kill many more people. And it's something that, you know, Dame Sally Davies in the film says it's going to kill us quicker than climate change. And I think that's frightening, looking at the state of climate change at the moment and where we're at, and the recent IPCC report. The fact that antimicrobial resistance is something which is a little bit more frightening even than that is, it's, you know, worrying. And it's something that really needs to come into the public eye. I think it, particularly the fact that we're squandering these medicines in livestock that we do not need at all.
Yeah, this is it. I mean, you know, we kind of think, oh, I better not, you know, I'll do my bit by saying no to the antibiotics because, you know, the doctor says I might need it, but I think I'll be okay. So I'm sort of doing my bit but that's just a drop in the ocean. It's all, well, I think, did I say 70%? It's being fed to animals to help them to survive in these awful conditions. So antibiotics were invented, was it in the 1920s?
I believe so. I don't have it in front of me. Well, they weren't invented in the 1920s, but penicillin was produced around that time. But antibiotics in a very basic form have been around for centuries. You know, they've been used in ancient times in all sorts of different ways, using sort of mold, and it's all the same, but the process of manufacturing penicillin and making antibiotics, this thing that you sort of spread, that was developed, I think, in the 1920s. But it's really, since that point, people began to realize, actually, if we use these on farmed animals, not only will the animals grow faster, but also we can keep them alive in conditions that are pretty horrific. And so the use of them has just grown and grown. And in some parts of the world, I mean, here, for example, in the UK, the use of antibiotics as growth promoters have been banned. But really, there's no way of regulating that properly. And if you look at the UK and Europe, we compare ourselves to America and we say, actually, our antibiotic usage is much safer. So we're doing okay, but it's a bit of a false baseline because actually we're still using them to an extent that is incredibly detrimental. And one of the things when you hear this and you think, well, why isn't this publicized more? It must be some kind of like pseudoscience, you know, some conspiracy. But then you look at the data and it's coming from the key health authorities all over the world. And we have Dame Sally Davies, who was the former chief health advisor to the UK government, speaking within this film. And like Alice said, she described it as something that could potentially be more detrimental to human health than even climate change. And so it's something that everybody needs to start focusing on in the same way that we're focusing on climate change.
It's a lot of it is about money, isn't it? So, you know, governments keeping the big agricultural industries, not just in the US, but it's in the UK as well, I believe, that, you know, they're sort of trying to keep them happy. And that's why these changes aren't sort of, you know, being sort of championed by government. What can we do to change that?
I think it's becoming clearer by the second that the government do not care about us one bit, and nor do big companies trying to make money off us. So I think realizing that actually this is one way in which we can affect our impacts on climate change. We can prevent a future pandemic. We can prevent our life-saving medicines being rendered useless just by making simple changes in our own life, which is really the key message of the film, is to look at how we might be impacting all these things together. I think I forgot the original question there. I went off on some sort of soapbox situation. Sorry. Yeah, I think just realizing that we can actually make that change ourselves, and we vote with our wallets. You know, if we decide that we don't want to keep funding industries which are destroying our planet and causing great suffering for people and animals, you know, they're not going to have the money to continue. That's as simple as that.
I was just going to say, just on that, I think Dr. Aisha Akhtar said it quite nicely. She said, if we're going to be waiting for governments to do the right thing, we're going to be waiting an awfully long time. Mm-hmm. And we all, you know, have that power to make changes right now.
Yeah. I love the sort of ending to the film. It kind of concludes that science tells us, you know, if we're going to survive on this planet, and like I think you said, Alice, in the film, didn't you? You know, if we were going to continue how we were, we'd need like 10 planets or, you know, something like that. So if we're going to survive on this planet, and, you know, okay, we might be all right, our children might be all right, but our grandchildren might not. And it goes on and on. And do we want to see that kind of world for our grandchildren or their children? So, you know, it's a difficult thing to come to terms with, I think, for a lot of people, because they don't want to give up meat. So, you know, how do we get around this? You know, we're being told by science that we need to go vegan to, you know, for so many different reasons. But what can we do about the people that just don't want to do it?
I think one is just sharing information like this in a way that is easy for people to understand the real severity, but also realizing that we're going to get to a point where we don't actually have a choice. You know, we're not going to be able to grow crops to feed animals for that much longer, because we're destroying the soil. We're not going to have the climate. We're you know, using all our water in inappropriate ways. We're not going to be able to treat the disease in the animals that we're currently throwing all our antibiotics at. And it's also causing massive, you know, public health issues, which we're not going to be able to afford. You know, the costs associated with farming animals are not sustainable in any way, and only takes a pandemic with a higher mortality rate than COVID to literally cripple us as a species. You know, we've seen, it's been almost like quite a useful, almost like a dress rehearsal, if you like, COVID-19, because what we've seen is that everything that we're assured by governments is going to happen. You know, if there's a problem, we will fix it, we'll create a vaccine, we'll, you know, lock people down, come up with biosecurity measures, etc. And we've lost over 5 million people, I think maybe it's even 6 now. And, you know, we've been crippled for 2-3 years now. What are we on? 2 years, and not been able to do anything. I think it's very obvious that we can't do stuff reactively. It has to all be preventative. And the only way to prevent getting diseases from animals is to stop messing with the animals in the first place.
Yeah, we're just sticking a plaster over things, aren't we? It's like, oh, we're great, we've got a vaccine. But, you know, like you say, what about when the next thing comes along? And it's, you know, it's impacted people, even if they haven't experienced, you know, someone sadly dying that they know or in their family. I mean, personally, you know, my daughter has not been in school for 6 months because she has such severe anxiety. You know, I was made redundant. I mean, that's just me, one person. It's impacted so many people losing their jobs. You know, it's just been massive. So I think this film couldn't have come at a better time. And thank you both for making it. And as many people as we can get to watch it, the better. It's launching in the US on the 10th of May. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. On Apple TV, iTunes, I think a few others, but I can't remember off the top of my head. But those are the main ones. In terms of a UK release, we're still working on that with our distributors, and hopefully we'll have some news soon. We want to release the film at around the same time. We just don't know what exact date and where it's going to go. But as soon as we do, we'll be posting about it on The End of Medicine's Instagram page and trying to spread the word.
Fantastic. Yeah, well, anyone listening, as soon as it is available to watch, definitely download it and share the hell out of it with your friends and family. Force them to watch it, because if they're not vegan, they sure as hell will be after that. Thank you so much for joining me today, guys.
I'll be back on Tuesday when Molly will be returning from her holiday in Portugal. And on Thursday, I'm chatting to founder of Bowl, Paul Brown, all about how we can get more plants into our diet.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.